Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Tuesday, September 15th. I'm your reader, Bob. Looking at the front page this morning, it looks like The Courier is predicting hazy sunshine with a high of 83 and a low of 60 tonight. Articles on the front page include GBPAC gets $1 million gift, UNI scraps spring break, coronavirus quarantines drop at UNI, and let's start with Branstad resigns as ambassador to China. This article filed by the Associated Press. Beijing. The U.S. ambassador to China will step down early next month, ending a three-year tenure marked by a trade war and increasingly bitter relations between the world's two largest economies. Former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, appointed by President Donald Trump in 2017, confirmed his decision in a phone call with Trump last week, the U.S. Embassy said in a statement Monday. It did not give a reason for his departure. Quote, I am proudest of our work in getting the Phase 1 trade deal and delivering tangible results for our communities back home, he was quoted as saying at an embassy staff meeting on Monday. Trump reportedly told U.S. Senator Joni Ernst over the weekend that Branstad is coming home because he wants to campaign, unquote. Iowa Republicans hailed Branstad's return as they fight to re-elect Trump and Ernst. Democrats called Branstad's surprise decision to step down to hit the fall campaign trail a sign of GOP desperation. Word of his departure leaked out earlier in the day when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo thanked Branstad on Twitter for his service. Ambassador Branstad has contributed to rebalancing U.S.-China relations so that it is results-oriented, reciprocal, and fair, Pompeo wrote in a follow-up tweet. China's foreign ministry said before the embassy announcement it was aware of Pompeo's tweet, but had not received any notification that Branstad was leaving. Branstad became embroiled in a recent controversy when China's official People's Daily newspaper rejected an opinion column that he had written. Pompeo tweeted last week that China's ruling Communist Party refused to run Branstad's op-ed while the Chinese ambassador to the United States, quote, is free to publish in any U.S. media outlet, unquote. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Luan responded that Branstad's article was full of loopholes, seriously inconsistent with facts, and wantonly attacks and smears China, unquote. The U.S. Embassy has contacted the People's Daily on August 26 about the piece, asking that it be printed in full without any edits before September 4th, the People's Daily said in a statement posted online. Branstad, 73, is a native of Iowa and was governor of the major farming state for 22 years over two spans, from 1983 to 1999 and 2011 to 2017. Early in his first term, he met Xi Jinping, now China's leader, when the then county-level Communist Party official visited Iowa on a 1985 trade trip. Trump appointed him ambassador after a vacancy of several months, during which the embassy's number two official, David Rank, resigned after criticizing the Trump administration's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Soon after arriving in Beijing in June 2017, Branstad welcomed American beef back to the Chinese market after a 14-year ban, saying, quote, I know it is a key priority of the president to reduce the trade deficit, and this is one of the ways we can do it, unquote. But trade relations quickly soured as the U.S. imposed tariffs on Chinese products and China retaliated in kind. Other disputes followed over technology, human rights, and the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Branstad joined U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin at trade talks with Chinese counterparts in Beijing in May 2019. The Phase 1 deal reached the following January represented a truce but did not address the more fundamental complaints of the American side. The U.S. Embassy statement also noted Branstad's role in the effort to reduce the flow of fentanyl from China to the United States, including a 2018 pact in which China agreed to list the opioid as a controlled substance. Branstad also made a rare visit to Tibet on May 2019, where he expressed concerns about what the U.S. called Chinese government interference in the freedom of Tibetan Buddhists to organize and practice their religion. Quote, he encouraged the Chinese government to engage in substantive dialogue with the Dalai Lama or his representatives without preconditions to seek a settlement that resolved differences, an embassy statement said at the time. GBPAC gets $1 million gift. The article opens with an artist's rendition of a new entry plaza for the Gallagher Blue Dorn, which will allow patients to use the drop-off lane to its full potential, creating an outdoor room for events. The multipurpose room will showcase sponsor and patron events, while roof terrace at the balcony level is also planned. This article filed by Melody Parker of the Waterloo Courier. Gallagher Foundation pledges to help $14.5 million renovation expansion. Cedar Falls. The Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center has received a $1 million gift from the Family Foundation, whose name is already on the building. The Gallagher Family Foundation has pledged $1 million toward the estimated $14.5 million renovation of the center. Located on the University of Northern Iowa campus, the Performing Arts Center is now 20 years old. Quote, when the late Ed and Kathy Gallagher gave their original gift toward the Performing Arts Center at UNI, they envisioned a facility that would serve as a beacon for arts and music, a cultural center that would enrich the quality of life across the Cedar Valley and the state of Iowa, said UNI President Mark Nook. The GBPAC Great Hall will be renamed the Catherine Cassidy Gallagher Great Hall in tribute to Kathy Gallagher, an alumnus of the University of Northern Iowa. The Gallagher Family Foundation, led by Ed and Kathy's children and grandchildren, continues the family's philanthropic legacy today. Quote, my parents believed that support of the arts in our community was a continuing responsibility, said Edward J. Gallagher III, president of the Gallagher Family Foundation. Quote, the Gallagher Family Foundation is making this gift to ensure that a great place for the performing arts and community and universities gatherings can be made even better. The $23 million, 100,000 square feet Performing Arts Center opened in 2000 and has become a regional attraction, in addition to serving as a home for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra and a resource for students at the UNI School of Music. The facility features three state-of-the-art concert halls that provide flexibility in hosting large-scale productions such as Broadway shows, as well as more intimate performances. The Great Hall seats 1,600 and offers state-of-the-art theater technology and stellar acoustics. The nearby Davis Hall, a 300-seat acoustically excellent hall, and the cathedral-like 125-seat Jeb Organ Hall, with its $500,000 handcrafted pipe organ, round out the venues. A soaring glass-walled lobby welcomes visitors. It was originally intended to host 150 events annually and serve 12,000 to 14,000 guests. Today, the center hosts more than 600 events annually and serves more than 115,000 guests, and actual usage nearly 10 times the initial projection. The Gallagher Blue Dorn has become a cultural centerpiece of the Cedar Valley since its opening, said Steve Carringham, executive director of the Gallagher Blue Dorn. Quote, each year, this facility has showcased the world's finest artists, ensembles of the UNI School of Music, the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony, and many other events and educational programs. The success of the facility is a direct result of the support of the Gallaghers and other donors have provided the center since its inception, unquote. When the original Performing Arts Center was being built, The budget required trimming the facility's wish list, Kerrigan recalled. Rather than sacrifice the Great Hall's 1,600-seat capacity for a smaller auditorium, the decision was made to cut patron spaces, restrooms, catering, and storage. Quote, usually the first response is to shrink the number of seats, go for a smaller hall. If not for Ed Gallagher and Howard Jones prioritizing what was important, that might have happened. But a 900-seat Great Hall wasn't economically viable in this market, unquote. The late Jones, a UNI professor emeritus who directed the UNI Artist Series program for 31 seasons before retiring in 1991, was an early advocate for the facility. The $14.5 million renovation and expansion returns the focus to patron services. Quote, it's an opportunity for us to elevate the overall experience and to match an evening of quality entertainment or a great performance with the social aspects of having an evening out and the amenities that patrons appreciate, unquote, Kerrigan explained. Presently, the center lacks the ability to host donor and sponsor events or meet and greets before or after shows, which reduces revenue streams and impacts the ability to cross-program with the School of Music and other university and public entities. Interior improvements include a secured coat room, modern restrooms, and a multipurpose room for performances, sponsor and patron events, private dinners, and before and after the show gatherings. In addition, there will be improved seating and concessions. New administrative offices will be part of a second level addition connected to the existing balcony level. A roof terrace at the balcony level also is planned. An elegant patron lounge is planned, and a new box office will be handled like a concierge service, Carnegie said. Overall, there will be 15,000 square feet of new and renovated space. Quote, we'll be doing a lot of reallocating of space during the renovation process, Kerrigan said, adding that the expansion and renovation will be completed in three phases. Exterior upgrades will include relieving congestion on the entry level by adding an additional drive lane near the building's main entry. A new entry plaza will allow patrons to use the drop-off lane to its full potential, as well as create an outdoor space for events. Quote, we are very appreciative of the Gallagher's family for their continued support of both our university and the Cedar Valley, Nook said. Just like the Gallagher Blue Dorn and the performances it hosts, this gift is an inspiration to our community. The renovated Gallagher Blue Dorn will continue to strengthen and inspire UNI and the Cedar Valley for decades to come, unquote. The Gallagher Family Foundation's gift was made to the University of Northern Iowa through the UNI Foundation. For more information about the UNI Foundation, visit uni-foundation.org. Now, two more articles about UNI from the front page. UNI Scraps Spring Break, filed by Andrew Wind. And it opens with a photograph of Jim Walpart. Cedar Falls, the University of Northern Iowa, is starting second semester 2 weeks later than planned and scrapping spring break to minimize COVID-19 risks. Spring classes will begin January 25th, which is 2 weeks later than the original starting date, the university announced Monday. Classes will be held during spring break, which had been scheduled for March 15th through the 19th. Final exams will take place May 3rd through the 7th, as originally planned. Quote, the decision to alter our spring semester calendar was made after many conversations and discussions on campus, including with faculty, students, department heads, and deans, Jim Walpart, provost and executive vice president for academic affairs, said in a statement. Quote, the Summer Forward Together Teaching and Learning Committee, which included faculty and students, made an initial recommendation to alter the spring semester. Faculty Senate leaders, with whom the administration consults on the academic calendar, then conferred and agreed that such an altered semester without spring break would be a good approach. We discussed several options and landed on this one. Quote, we also conferred with Northern Iowa student government leaders, academic advising, athletics, and senior leadership before a final decision was made, Walpart said. The University of Iowa in Iowa City and Iowa State University in Ames have announced similar changes. They are also delaying the start of second semester until January 25th and not having a spring break in March. A news release said UNI's plans for spring semester are building on the early success we have seen with schedule modification that allowed for in-person fall classes. Quote, these changes will give us the opportunity to further protect our campus community while still holding a full spring semester of on-campus teaching and learning activities, it noted. Fall semester started a week early, and classes were held on Labor Day. Final exams will wrap up November 25th, the day before Thanksgiving. In past years, the semester continued after a Thanksgiving break. No in-person classes are planned on campus until January 25th, start of spring semester. A UNI spokesman said residence halls and dining facilities will stay open during the extended two-month break for any student who remains on campus. However, he noted, it is common for most students to leave UNI during the holiday season. The modified calendar will allow UNI to offer select classes during 3- and 6-week winter terms through distance learning. Students will be able to learn more about these classes through their departments and in the spring schedule of classes. UNI hits low point on student quarantine and isolation, filed by Andrew Wind. Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa has hit a low point in the number of students in quarantine and isolation on campus this fall. According to Department of Residence figures reported on UNI's online COVID-19 dashboard, there are 30 students in quarantine and one in isolation as of Monday. The university's numbers have been trending down since September 3rd, when the department reported 91 students in quarantine and 32 in isolation. There have been fewer students in both categories for each subsequent Thursday and Monday report. Students are quarantined away from others for 14 days when they might have been exposed to someone with COVID-19. Students are asked to self-isolate for 10 days if they are diagnosed with the disease. UNI's Student Health Center reported 20 positive coronavirus tests during the week of September 7th through 13th, according to a Monday update of the dashboard. A total of 147 tests were administered, with the other 127 cases negative. That is a positivity rate of 13.61% for the week. During the same week, there were 13 new self-reported student and employee cases, which can duplicate health center's cases. Since September 1st, there have been 48 self-reported cases, one of them an employee. Since August 17th, the health center has administered 596 tests, 135 of which came back positive for COVID-19. Both UNI students and employees can get tested at the clinic. Wartburg College in Waverly had 9 current positive or inclusive tests Monday, according to its updated online COVID-19 dashboard. That was a drop from 42 on Friday, putting its campus infection rate at 0.4%. The college's numbers include all Wartburg students and employees. Wartburg also reported 12 people in isolation and 39 in quarantine as of Monday. Let's turn now to the Cedar Valley page. Virtual education still not a reality for some Waterloo schools students, filed by Andrew Wind. Waterloo. For students who chose virtual education this fall, Waterloo Community Schools officials are emphasizing that their learning needs to be actual. About 22% of the district's approximately 10,400 students are enrolled in the in-home-based online learning option offered because of COVID-19 concerns. But as the third week of online classes get underway, some of them aren't making adequate progress on the self-paced, internet-based curriculum. Quote, we do have students who have not logged on yet, Superintendent Jane Lindemann told the Board of Education Monday. Quote, kids should have logged in by now. They really should be logging in by now, unquote. In-person classes began August 24th, followed by online students a week later, on August 31st. Virtual students are using a curriculum created by the company Edgenuity, which is aligned to district and state standards. Waterloo School's administrators are tracking how many of them are logging on, when it's happening, and how long they're working. Quote, we can see every single day how that student is doing, said Lindemann, including results on various assessments after completing lessons. Those who aren't engaging at all are a focus for administrators and the teachers they are assigned to. District's staff are making one-on-one calls to find out what is keeping them from participating. They work with families on technology issues and can get them a cellular hotspot the same day if internet accessibility is a problem. Lindemann reported that truancy rules will apply to those who never log on to the system or don't make the necessary progress, but the district works with students before taking such measures. Waterloo's virtual teachers are typically assigned 80 to 120 students based on grade level, she said. Limited staffing has resulted in an even heavier load of 200 students for at least one teacher. They are required to contact students every 2 weeks through online video meetings. Quote, it seems like an extraordinarily long time between contacts, said board member Lyle Schmidt. Officials said that relates to the staffing limits. The district moved all teachers who wanted to work with online students into those positions. They also assigned other teachers to virtual education who hadn't requested the positions and continue looking at the needs. Quote, we work on virtual staffing every day, said Stephanie Mohorn, Associate Superintendent for Educational Services. Parents and students are reaching out to teachers more frequently through phone calls and emails. I think to say they are getting hundreds of emails a day would not be out of line, Lindemann said of the teachers. They are working to respond to those within 24 hours. Despite such challenges, she said the district has done a good job of developing and implementing its plans to educate students during the coronavirus pandemic. Quote, I feel like we should be really proud of the work we've brought forward with the Return to Learn plan, said Lindemann. I think it's gone really well, unquote. In other business, the board approved an $884,616 contract with the Tri-County Child and Family Development Council to provide Head Start preschool classes for 174 children at the Elk Run Early Childhood Center and other Waterloo schools' buildings during the next year. Waterloo City Council approves $4 million in bond money for a convention center, filed by Sydney Sison. Waterloo. It opens with a photograph of the five Sullivan Brothers Convention Center in downtown Waterloo, with quite a bit of construction materials and trucks shown in the foreground. Waterloo City Council members unanimously voted Monday evening to approve $4 million in general obligation bonds to fund renovations at the five Sullivan Brothers Convention Center. The bonds, slated to be sold next spring, will mainly fund lobby remodeling at the center. The bonds and accumulated interest will be repaid from property taxes, according to a memo. Council members agreed Monday to award Waterloo company Cardinal Construction a $5.5 million bid to do the lobby work. Council member Dave Boson questioned how the city would pay for lobby renovations that exceed the bond amount by more than $1 million. Quote, we do have existing bond funds that were put forth for convention center improvements, so the combination of those with these new funds, we should have enough to cover the project, said Noel Anderson, Community Planning and Development Director. Anderson confirmed to Boson that the existing bond money is left over from other projects, including chiller, roof, and ceiling work at the convention center. The city used more than $5 million in general obligation bonds for convention center renovations in the past couple of years. The council approved another $3.7 million for convention center work in June. The $5.5 million in renovations will include the removal of escalators, addition of at least one elevator, and an atrium addition to the main entrance on the corner of Commercial and West 4th Streets. The downtown convention center's lobby renovations will take about a year, Anderson said. The contractor agreement shows the project has a substantial completion date for August 13, 2021. The project is expected to be finished September 3, 2021. Cardinal Construction competed against three other bidders for the project, but ultimately provided the largest deduction for removing stepped foundations at the facility. All three bidders originally set their top prices above $6 million. The city engineer estimated the project to cost $4.4 million. Anderson said the gap between the projected and actual costs might be due to increased product costs from COVID-19 and derecho. He added that contractors might have to charge more money if they are busy with other projects. A city memo cited the COVID-19 pandemic as a convenient time to complete renovations in the center. Quote, "It's the city's best interest to do major renovations during the time that the demand for events at the center is lower due to pandemic," the memo said. Quote, "We hope to reduce the negative impact on the city's operating budget by proceeding with these projects at this time. EPA sides with farmers on ethanol, rejects refinery waivers, filed by David Pitt of the Associated Press. Federal regulators Monday handed a victory to corn farmers and the renewable fuels industry by refusing to allow a group of petroleum refiners in 14 states to forego requirements to blend ethanol into the gasoline they make. Members of Congress from five states have heavily lobbied President Donald Trump to reject the waiver requests for months. Those representing oil-producing states supported the waivers, which were originally designed to help small refineries that struggled financially to meet federal mandated ethanol targets. In recent years, however, larger refineries also have received exemptions from the Trump administration. The petroleum refiners had sought 54 exemptions retroactively, some as far back as 2011, that would have allowed the petroleum industry to remove hundreds of millions of gallons of corn-based ethanol from the market. Significant exemptions from the congressional requirement of blending at least 15 billion gallons of ethanol a year into the nation's fuel supply began after Trump took office and appointed Andrew Wheeler as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. By agreeing to reject the waivers, the Trump administration is essentially fixing a problem it created. Congressional Republicans, including Iowa Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, nevertheless, lauded Trump for the decision. Quote, "I applaud President Trump for keeping his word and supporting our farmers and biofuel producers," Grassley said in a statement. Democratic Representative Abby Finkenauer agreed with the EPA decision will help Iowa farmers, but called out Trump administration for approving previous waivers that removed 4 billion gallons of ethanol from production and waiting, quote, "until 50 days before an election to finally take even this modest action," unquote. A petroleum industry group response was critical of EPA and Trump. Quote, "The notion that this administration is, quote, following the rule of the law, though it's through its latest betrayal of the U.S. refinery workers, is laughable," said Chet Thompson, CEO of the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, a trade group for producers of fuel and petrochemicals used in many products. While maintaining the ethanol production levels, the EPA decision also is likely to bring an end to the small refinery exemptions that have plagued the ethanol industry. If the decision isn't appealed, or if it is upheld on appeal, only a few small refineries would remain eligible for waivers, said Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, a trade group. About 40% of the nation's corn crop is used for ethanol, making such decisions critical for the economy of Iowa, the nation's leading corn and ethanol producer. Many farmers who grow corn were early investors in the ethanol industry and have significant stakes in the industry. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Tuesday, September 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Charles Charlie Sievers, 78 of Waterloo, died Friday, September 11th, 2020, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. He was born April 23rd, 1942, in Lisbon, son of Laverne and Wilma Sievers. He graduated from Mount Vernon High School. Charlie served in the United States Navy during the Vietnam War until his honorable discharge in 1967. He was awarded many awards and commendations during his service. He married Joanne Coleman on November 18, 1994. Charlie worked as a semi-driver and machinist for John Deere for many years. He was a member of the American Legion, AMVETS, and Waterloo Eagles Club, and attended Grace Baptist Church. Charlie enjoyed fishing, making birdhouses, and tinkering in his garage. He also spent his free time socializing with his coffee friends and playing cards at the Eagles. Services are 1 p.m. on Thursday, September 17, 2020, at Kern's Funeral Service, burial at Garden of Memories Cemetery. Visitation 1 hour prior to services at Kern's. Memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society and the American Parkinson Disease Association. Go to www.kernsfuneralservice.com for more information. Stephen B. Hook, 74, of Wellsburg, Iowa, went to be with the Lord on September 11, 2020, with his family by his side at Allen Hospital in Waterloo, Iowa. Private funeral services will be held Wednesday, September 16, 2020. Steve's funeral service will be live-streamed at Anderson Funeral Home's Facebook page at 10:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, Wednesday, September 16, 2020. Anderson Funeral Homes of Conrad, Iowa, has been entrusted with the arrangements. Online condolences may be sent to www.andersonfhs.com. Steve was born to Lester and Fern Hook on October 1, 1945, in Marshalltown, Iowa. He graduated from Wellsburg High School with the class of 1963. Steve attended the University of Iowa for 2 years and subsequently took a job as an inhalation therapist at Mercy Hospital in Des Moines. He was united in marriage with Pamela Amon on September 25, 1965, at the Second Christian Reformed Church, now United Reformed Church, in Wellsburg, where he served many years as an elder. Steve was drafted into the Army on October 10, 1966, and served in Vietnam as a medic in a helicopter ambulance unit. He was seriously wounded several times, the last time requiring more than 6 months of hospitalization. Steve was inducted into the Dustoff Association Hall of Fame in San Antonio in February 2002 and the Army Aviation Association of American Hall of Fame in April 2011 in Nashville. He was also honored to appear on the TV show War Stories with Oliver North, filmed at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. Steve worked 31 years at the Wellsburg Post Office, 27 of them as postmaster. He enjoyed hobbies such as golfing, hunting, and fishing. Steve also cherished time with his brother from the 54th Medical Detachment and watching his two granddaughters' sporting events. Marianne Lecker, 93, of Waterloo, died Monday, September 14th, at home. She was born May 6, 1927, in St. Louis, Missouri, daughter of Charles and Lillian Baer. She married John Lecker on November 22, 1946, in Waterloo, Illinois. He died August 7, 1993. Marianne was employed in the lunchroom of West Intermediate School for 26 years, retiring in 1990. She was an avid quilter, gardener, and reading. She loved to fish, play cards, and was a volunteer with Cedar Valley Hospice for more than 20 years. She loved spending time with family, especially her grandchildren. A private graveside service will be held at Mount Olivet Cemetery. There will be no visitation. Haggerty Wyckoff Grourup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice. Condolences may be left with www.haggertywyckoffgrourup.com. Bruce Raymond Bixby, 75, of Clarksville, Iowa, died September 12, 2020, at his home. Bruce was born on May 4, 1945, at St. Francis Hospital in Waterloo. The son of Raymond and Isabel Bixby, he was raised in Janesville and graduated from Janesville High School in 1963. Bruce was united in marriage to his high school sweetheart, Rebecca Berry, on July 24, 1964, at Falls Avenue Wesleyan Methodist Church in Waterloo. The couple spent their lives together farming southwest of Clarksville. Bruce loved farming from a young age, and it was both livelihood and hobby for him. He also loved sharing his farm home and stories with his family and the many neighbors and friends who visited. He was a member of the Unity Presbyterian Church, rural Clarksville, where he served as deacon and elder, Iowa Pork Producers and Farm Bureau. Visitation will be held on Friday, September 18th, from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. at Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 19th, at Allison Congregational Church in Allison, with Pastor Greg Harris officiating. Burial will follow at Harlington Cemetery in Waverly. Memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice, and online condolences may be left at www.kaisercorson.com at phone number area code 319-352-1187. Eric Rick Charles Snyder passed away at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center on Thursday, September 10, 2020. He was born in West Union, Iowa on March 10, 1962. He graduated from Decorah High School, where he met the love of his life, Christine. The two married on August 13, 1983. Eric attended Luther College, as well as UNI. Upon having their first of three children, they moved to Cedar Falls, where Eric began his career as a life insurance agent. Eric was an avid cook who enjoyed singing karaoke, watching westerns, and playing cards. In his earlier years, Eric was a part of the Frozen Peppers. He enjoyed making people laugh and was always the life of the party. One thing he will be remembered for is opening parties with his version of Mustang Sally. Memorials may be directed to the family or to Shriners Children's Hospital. Cards may be sent to Eric's daughter, Caitlin, at 1315 West 8th Street, Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613. A celebration of life will be held on Wednesday, September 16th, at 11 a.m. at Gateway Park in Cedar Falls. You are welcome to wear a mask if that makes you feel more comfortable. There will be hand sanitizer stations as well. Online condolences may be made at www.fjelstul.com. Craig Stephen Hayes was born in Waterloo, Iowa on October 1, 1948, to parents Carol and Virginia Hayes. He graduated from Dysart Geneseo High School in 1967 and Ellsworth Community College in Iowa Falls. Craig lived in many places, including Oklahoma and Colorado. He settled in Minneapolis and began his career as a machinist with the Toro Company. Craig enjoyed playing guitar and other instruments. He loved photography, reading his Bible, spending time with his cat Snickers, visiting his family's farm in Iowa, and riding his motorcycle. On May 21, 2016, Craig married Janet Oval. They moved to Farmington, Minnesota, and enjoyed their time together before Craig passed away on September 10, 2020. Craig's family will remember his kindness and his sense of humor. Despite his physical challenges, Craig never complained and always expressed gratitude toward others. A private service will be held at the Geneseo Cemetery near Geneseo United Methodist Church, Buckingham, Iowa, on September 17, 2020. Memorials may be directed to the Jubilee Fund at the National Christian Foundation, which will allow the family to direct the donations to Craig's favorite charities. That Jubilee Fund number is 209-4013. Marlene Elizabeth Sutherland, 81, of Chipola, passed away Thursday, September 10, 2020, at Bartles Lutheran Home in Waverly. She was born on May 30, 1939, in Sumner, to Clarence and Celia Miller. Marlene graduated from Sumner High School, May 1957, and American Floral Arts School in Chicago, September 1957. She married Alan Sutherland, July 28, 1962, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Sumner. She enjoyed spending time with friends and family, going to flea markets, craft shows, doing craft projects, sewing flowers, and floral designing. Over the years, she worked at several flower shops, including Rainbow Florist, for a time. Visitation is Thursday, September 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church Rectory in Sumner. Funeral service is Friday, September 18th, at 10:30 a.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church in Sumner. Burial will be at Wilson Grove Cemetery in Sumner. Now let's pick up the last of the local news before turning to sports. In the public safety roundup, rash of slashed tires investigated. Waterloo. Police are investigating a weekend vandalism spree that left numerous vehicles with flat tires. Residents began reporting slashed tires around 10:30 p.m. Saturday, and by Monday morning, the total surpassed 20 cars and trucks, according to police. Damage was contained to the city's west side, with reports in the 500 block of West 8th Street, 600 block of Johnson Street, 600 block of Grant Street, 300 and 400 blocks of Allen Street, and 800 block of West 2nd Street. No arrests have been made. Anyone with information is asked to call Waterloo Police at 319-291-4340. Cedar Falls. One person has been arrested for allegedly breaking into the garage of a Cedar Falls church in April. Cedar Falls police arrested Melvin Donnell Manning, 38, of 814 South Street, Waterloo, on Wednesday on a charge of third-degree burglary. According to police, someone broke into the Community of Christ Church garage at 4616 Cedar Heights Drive in early April while the church was closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. A power washer, fire pit, and yard tiller were taken, and investigators found 3 cigarette butts at the scene. DNA from the butts was consistent with Manning, including, according to court records. The investigation into the church burglary continues, according to the police. Court records show Manning had been at large since September 2018, when he disappeared while on probation for a theft charge. Motorcycle deer collision injures 2. Dunkerton. 2 motorcyclists were taken to the hospital following a Sunday crash outside Dunkerton. Both were traveling north on North Raymond Road around 7:05 p.m. Sunday when one hit a small deer that darted into the roadway from a ditch. The other motorcyclist lost control trying to avoid the first motorcyclist, according to the Blackhawk County Sheriff's Office. Both were taken to Unity Point Allen Hospital in Waterloo with minor injuries. Waterloo man faces gun charge. Waterloo. A second person has been arrested on gun charges stemming from a January incident outside a strip club. Waterloo police arrested Anthony Fernell Jackson, 32, of 754 Ryle Street on September 6 for felon in possession of a firearm and carrying weapons. He was later released pending trial. Court records allege Jackson and another man, Dontre Bundy of Des Moines, handled a pistol in the parking lot behind Flirt's Gentlemen's Club on Jefferson Street on January 31st. Bundy allegedly fired a shot into the air and then placed the weapon into a parked car. Officers searched the car and found a stolen Smith & Wesson 9mm pistol and a .40 caliber Bonifacio Ecuvara Firestar handgun. Police said Jackson is prohibited from handling firearms because of a 2006 robbery conviction. Bundy was arrested in January and placed pleaded to gun and firearm charges in June. Authorities seek Waterloo escapee. Waterloo. Authorities are looking for a Waterloo man who fled a halfway house over the weekend. Dennis George DeVore III, 33, was placed on work release while serving time for domestic assault with strangulation when he failed to report back to the Waterloo residential facility on Sunday morning. DeVore is described as a white male, 5 feet 6 inches tall, and weighing 208 pounds. He was admitted to the work release facility on August 24th. Waverly approves second reading of fireworks ordinance limiting fireworks in July to 3 days, filed by Amy Rivers. Waverly, while one council member advocated for an outright ban and another for leaving the law alone, Waverly is on track to limit displays of fireworks within city limits to just 3 days in early July, rather than 2 weeks. Council members voted 5-2 to approve the second reading of the ordinance, meaning it will likely be passed at the next council meeting. The ordinance would shorten the city's window for shooting off fireworks from 2 weeks to 3 days between July 3rd and the 5th. The New Year's time frame was not addressed by the amendment. Quote, the majority of comments that I heard were it needed to be shortened dramatically. There were a few that wanted it banned, and a few wanted it left alone, said at-large member Ann Wraith. This might be a good compromise to leave it at 3 days. Ward member Tim Kagus voted against the new restrictions, making a motion instead for a total ban on shooting off fireworks within city limits. Quote, it's confusing enough for people as it is to fit in all the little details of when and where it's legal to set off fireworks, Kanga said. It's just easier to say, you can't do it. That's much easier to enforce. Though Kangas's motion received a second, it was defeated 6-1. Ward member Heather Bufour agreed the city's ordinance was confusing and voted no with Kangas on the original ordinance, but took the opposite track of wanting to leave the 2 weeks window alone. Quote, I haven't heard more than one or two people that want it banned, she said. I've heard some people who are willing to compromise, but a lot of people are saying no. This is already confusing enough when it doesn't match the state, unquote. Ward 1 member Brian Bergen said he wanted to balance the enjoyment of fireworks with residents' concern about the nightly onslaught. Quote, I think 2 weeks was really a burden on pet owners and people with PTSD, and I think that was too much, he said. But I don't think an outright ban is the next step, unquote. Ward 3 member Rodney Drenkow said the ordinance has been confusing because the city has failed to properly communicate it and said communication may help stem future problems. But he said he also wouldn't be afraid to ban fireworks if it came to that. Quote, I'm willing to give this 3-day window a couple of years, Drenkow said. Quote, if we still have a problem we did in the past, we simply ban it. This is putting everybody on notice, unquote. On the sports page now, Iowa State football, college football, Cyclones have room for improvement, by Ben Visser, the sports correspondent for the Courier. Ames, Iowa State's running game mirrored much of what happened on the field Saturday as the Cyclones lost 31-14 to Louisiana. Breece Hall looked good for much of the first half, rushing for 77 yards and a touchdown, but he also lost a fumble. Iowa State looked good for much of the first half as well. The Cyclones led 14-10, but Louisiana's touchdown came on a kick return. In the second half, Hall's production plummeted, and he rushed for just 19 yards. He only had one rush in the fourth quarter for 4 yards. Iowa State's second half was atrocious. The team gave up a 78-yard touchdown pass to Peter LeBlanc. The special teams gave up a punt return touchdown, and the offense in general had a hard time doing anything. Despite Hall's relatively good game, rushing 20 times for 103 yards and a touchdown, Coach Matt Campbell knows there is more to sophomore running back, and that more doesn't have to be much to do with actually running the ball. It's the other parts of the game. Much like how Iowa State's problems on Saturday weren't with the primary parts of the game, It was special teams that doomed the Cyclones. Quote, he didn't look like what I would say is his mid-season form by any stretch of the imagination, Campbell said on Monday during the Big 12's weekly teleconference. There was some sloppiness in his game, and that was relatable to our football team. His pass protection and ball security need to improve. The one positive from the game was our ability to, at times, run the ball. But Breece can be better, and it will be better. The natural progression of our team in general, Breece is right in line with that. So what prompted the second half switch away from the run? In Campbell's eyes, the switch didn't happen until the fourth quarter. Hall still rushed the ball 7 times in the third quarter, but he only gained 2.1 yards per carry. In the first half, he gained 6.3 yards per carry. Quote, a little bit of it is the situation, Campbell said. Quote, we ran the ball on the first 2 drives of the second half. Then they hit the long ball, and we started to press. We drove the ball again, and then we punted the ball, and it's suddenly 24-14, and the game changes. Instead of trying to be balanced, you're trying to play catch-up. The run game was really positive for 3 quarters, and then went by the wayside in the fourth quarter. Some of the decrease in production can be attributed to Iowa State guard Trevor Downing going down with an injury late in the second quarter. But another aspect was Louisiana's shift to playing press man coverage and Iowa State's receivers' inability to get any sort of separation. It made it easy for the Raging Cajuns to key in on the run in the third quarter. Iowa State was also without all Big 12 tight end Charlie Kohler, who was out with an injury. In recent years, at every level of football, tight ends have become crucial aspects of a team's passing philosophy to try and create mismatches in the secondary. On Monday, Campbell provided updates for both Downing and Kohler. Quote, the update on Trevor is a sprained ankle, Campbell said. Quote, the thing that's hugely positive is I really do think we'll get him back by midweek. Charlie was able to practice in a limited capacity last week, but was not full go. Another big week for Charlie that hopefully puts him in a better situation. And I would say again that he's day-to-day, unquote. The National Football League reminds teams to follow sideline rules on face coverings, filed by the Associated Press. The NFL on Monday reminded team personnel on the sidelines about the COVID-19 requirements for wearing face coverings, saying such carelessness or disregard could put the season at risk. There were several games Sunday in which team members, other than players, did not use face coverings. Troy Vincent, who oversees the league's football operations, sent a memo to the 32 clubs. He stressed that teams must remain vigilant and disciplined in following the processes and protocols put in place by not only the league, union, and clubs, but also by state and local governments. After congratulating the teams for overcoming coronavirus challenges and beginning the regular season on time, Vincent strongly cautioned against undoing that work. He referred to the game day protocols developed by the league and the NFL Players Association that reflect the advice of infectious disease experts, club medical staffs, and local and state government regulations. Those require all individuals with bench area access, including coaches and members of the club medical staff, to wear face coverings at all times. Quote, failure to adhere to this requirement will result in accountability measures being imposed against offending individuals and or clubs, the memo said. The face covering must be worn as designed so that it securely fits across the wearer's nose and mouth to prevent the transmission of the virus, unquote. Punishment for not adhering to the protocols has not been announced, but could include anything from fines to ejection from the sideline. Quote, all individuals with bench area access, except for players, shall be required to wear masks at all times, the rules say. Quote, coaches must either wear a mask, neck gaiter, and or face shield to satisfy this obligation. Players who are not substituting into the game are strongly encouraged to wear masks on the sidelines. Except for at games played in stadiums with state or local regulations that make the wearing of masks mandatory. In such cases, players on the sidelines must wear masks. Becoming careless or ignoring face coverings and physical distancing requirements will put the 2020 season at risk, Vincent said. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Tuesday, September 15th. I'm your reader, Bob. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And please stay tuned for the reading of today's Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And thank you so much for listening today.